this week's edition of Books and Booze. We're here with Letitia Trent, author of Echo Lake. We're being brought to you this week by Keeping the Record by Travis Richardson, who's also going to be reading at Books and Booze Live this weekend. This is Renee, as always, and I'm going back to beer this weekend. I'm drinking a hibiscus wheat beer by a brewery called, like, Aztec. I don't know. My husband just brought it home. It smells amazing. Tastes okay. Not great. Not bad. Letitia, how are you doing and what are you drinking?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm not drinking anything very exciting. I feel like I'm not keeping with the theme of the podcast because I'm sick, so I'm drinking some throat coat tea. It should have whiskey in it or something. That would be appropriate, but it doesn't.
There you go. Jessica, what are you drinking?
I am drinking what I mentioned with my pre-show drink last week, the Bud Light Apple Rita.
I thought you said they were terrible.
They are terrible. I'm drinking it because I hate myself. No, I'm drinking it because we bought them. We got like a little case, so they have to be consumed. So this is the place for that. Also, they're like 8% alcohol, so, you know, I don't have to drink as many of these. Okay. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I just feel bad for you.
I'm sorry to myself. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry that my feelings about myself are so low that I'm drinking Apple Aritas, but...
Well, anybody who's been listening, like, semi-regularly knows I haven't actually been drinking on the show recently. Because I haven't been drinking at all. Like, not for any reason. It's just, like, I haven't been in the mood for it. I've been tired, whatever. So the first time I drank in, like, a month was our whiskey challenge where I took two double shots because I'm an idiot and don't know how to measure liquor. So I just, like, kind of, like, got stuck to the couch that night.
Oh.
It was terrible. But then today I get ready to call in to do the show, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to have a beer. And I open up the fridge, and we have, like, three different kinds of beer, one of each. And I was like, what has happened to me? This is outrageous. I have a beer selection. Like, anyway. So, Echo Lake is this the first book being released by Dark House Press? Is that right?
Yeah, it's the first original book. I think there was an anthology first,
right.
But it's the first kind of novel out, yeah.
Cool. And how's that been? Just out of, because, you know, like, I would think Dark House is kind of like a friend of the show kind of thing going on. I want to know, like, has it been a good experience? Is it fun, like, to be on this big forward role?
Yeah, I mean, I really like the press, and I just love the anthology so much. What is it called? The New Black?
Yeah.
Right.
And I was so taken with all the stories, and I thought, yeah, this is where I would love to be, you know, because it seemed to fit my aesthetic, and I like working with everybody. It's been great, really. I've really enjoyed it.
Wonderful.
It's always good to hear. It's always good when, like, a new small press, like, debuts with strong work. And, like, you know their quality, and you know they're not, like, screwing writers around.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Because, I mean, like, I could wake up tomorrow and be like, I'm starting a small press. And you
yeah, and so many people
that.
Do.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, the care they put into, like, the design and how everything looks and promotion, and I just feel very supported by them. So it's a good fit. I like it.
Wonderful.
Now, I want to know, I know that, like, this is kind of being presented as, like, neo-noir, but it does definitely have elements of horror in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also know that you were doing a lot of poetry before. So
mm-hmm.
I guess what I wonder is when you sat down to approach this novel and you have, assuming the idea for the story or however it started, Were you thinking about how you were going to incorporate all these different elements and your background and everything into it, or did you just sort of, like, let it flow?
Well, I mean, the poetry background, that's what I did my MFA in and what I mostly wrote for years and years. But I've always loved horror fiction. Like, I read so much Stephen King when I was a teenager, and even now I tend to read things that go in that direction. And so when I started writing prose, I started with, like, writing really shitty realist stories because I was in an MFA program, and I was like, oh, I'm going to be like Raymond Carver. Like, I had this idea. There were certain kinds of stories that are, like, more important than others, and they're realist stories, you know, psychological realism. I was going to do that. And I wrote some of that, but it was mostly just not very good. I mean, it, in my opinion, it wasn't very good. And it wasn't until I was like, okay, I love genre. That's what I kind of want to move in the direction towards. Then I started writing stories and novels that were kind of more, had more like horror, but I've never been a straight horror kind of person. I always kind of like, I like things to be sort of misty and atmospheric and unclear. And maybe that's my poetry background. I like language. I like mood more than anything. So I had to really figure out, like, okay, plot. How does that work? How do you make stuff happen? And, like, when you go from poetry to prose, one of the hardest things is, like, getting somebody across a room. Like, you know, just making movement happen in a story. Like, how much do you say? How much do you not say? I really had to, like, pay attention to what I was reading and how other people did it. And so that was a bit of a challenge for me. Yeah, I'm not sure if I totally answered that question, but...
Good. I think that's interesting that you said about like the mood and everything, because one of the notes I had was that the atmosphere that you create in that book, it really surrounds the reader. And I think the book itself just has an overall sense of dread that you go through, and it never really leaves you. And it's something that I think you did very well in there, is creating that atmosphere and that mood that goes with the reader.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I was actually saying before you got into the pre-show meeting, I was saying to Jessica, what I felt was impressive, and I think I can say this without giving anything away, or anything important away anyway, is as you hit the second half, it starts to really start, like, the suspense is just, like, gets crazy in that second half of the book. And what's interesting to me is that, one, you maintain that suspense even though you're breaking through different scenes and different storylines and different people's points of views throughout. But also that a lot of time when you're reading a book and the suspense starts really building, like, it's building toward the thing or the reveal, like, who did it or what caused it or whatever it might be. Whereas what I felt like is this whole thing is, it's like, how is this going to affect people? Which I think that's hard to pull off, to make that seem so important and so, like, scary, you know, like, oh my God, how is this going to affect? Because there's a lot of fiction that explores how events affect people, but they tend to be a little more relaxed, I guess. Like, it might be serious issues. I'm not saying that they're not serious issues, but I'm saying, like, you're not, oh my God, after this happens, what are the people going to do, you know?
Yeah.
It's really hard to talk around it without saying what's going on, but.
Well, yeah, but I love that, just what you said there, like, about how it's about how things affect people instead of, like, the thing being revealed. And I think that was my trouble at first, like, how do you, because I'm not super interested in kind of, like, who did it or, you know, those kind of answers. I realized I wasn't all that interested in,
yeah.
I'm not interested in, like, good and bad or who's the evil that needs to be rooted out and whatever. That just didn't interest me. But then I thought, okay, something else needs to interest me, because that's that's kind of the engine a lot of horror or genre or whatever category runs on. Like, where's the problem? What's the, but, you know, noir has the whole very gray, it's very shades of gray, but still there's a lot of, like, moving parts to it. And I had to figure out, like, what is the thing that's at stake, really?
Yeah, and what I liked, too, is that there's so many moments of ambiguity as far as what is right and what is wrong. And people's perceptions of events that happen and if they're right or wrong. So hard to talk about it without giving away like some of the awesome plot points. But I think the examples I'm thinking of are things that the reader is going to want to experience for themselves. So it seemed like there were certain points in the story, especially with the Connie story. I think that I can do this. Where things are happening and she's a part of things passively almost. And you're trying to figure out, like, as the reader, you're like wanting to shake her and explain to her what's really going on, you know, like, because she feels guilt about things that have happened, or she feels like something was misrepresented and people are being affected by it. And you want to, I don't know, you want to take a side, I feel like, is what I'm trying to say. Throughout the story, there's moments like that where something happens. I think I can give a little bit away without ruining it. Is, of course, the storyline is the Echo Lake, the town, there's a lot of dead people and a lot of disappearing people. And it's a small town, so, you know, there's, like, the small town secrets and things like that. So I think that's giving the listeners just enough to understand what I'm talking about, hopefully. So did you go into it, like, because I know you said you weren't interested in good and bad. So did you go into it kind of with the thought that every character was going to have a little bit of both up front and obviously these shades of gray, or did that kind of happen as the way the plot progresses? Obviously, in some cases, these characters have to be on both sides or it wouldn't work. But as far as all the supporting characters, when you start seeing that mix of good and bad, even characters who don't play an active role in the story, who are like in the past, have this weird balance of doing great things and doing bad things, and then like maybe the bad thing they did wasn't that bad, maybe it was actually the right thing, and you kind of, you know, I mean, you know, you wrote it, but
I think I really wasn't, I wanted to be intentional about not having good guys and bad guys. That was something I really wanted, because so often I feel disappointed when a book seems to come down to that, or when that's I am thinking of my old Stephen King love and how I would just devour those books. And but sometimes, even though he does have like shades of wrongness and rightness, sometimes it would come down to the kind of evil that we have to like figure out how to overcome. A lot of the plot points really do come down to that, like how do we overcome this evil? And I just didn't want anything to be evil. Even the lake, you know, whatever it represents, whatever it is a metaphor for, I don't know it's necessarily about evil. I think it's more about, like, how things get rolling in certain places. You get into this rut where life is just going on as it is, and you start to not see the way things are going wrong. And by the time people see it, it's too late to change. It's like a system. I think little towns are like systems. Every place is like a system where you set something rolling, and if somebody doesn't break out of the system and say, oh, my gosh, this is not a good idea, this is not working, then it just keeps perpetuating itself. And I think that was what I was more interested in, how people fit into a system and don't see their part in it and don't see how to get out of it.
I think one of the things I found really interesting in the book was Echo Lake itself, which is a man-made lake that was built over a town, basically. Like they flooded a town to create a lake, and that happens. I've seen those, and I've always been fascinated by those little flooded towns. So I wonder, it's incredibly creepy, isn't it? Just those weird things just under your feet. So I wonder, did you do very much research on those? And what inspired Echo Lake itself, like the idea of having that town under the lake?
Well, actually, I spent my teenage years in Oklahoma, like southeastern Oklahoma, very rural, very isolated. And there was Sardis Lake, which was a man-made lake that was made on top of an old town called
Sardis.
Yeah. And so, and there was a sort of cemetery, which was actually people were, the coffins were dug up and replanted in this cemetery that's kind of an island in Sardis Lake. And there was this event, I think it was in the 80s, when there was this huge flood, and that little island was flooded, and the caskets or coffins, I never know the right word, casket, coffin, pop up and came to, so it, that stuff actually did happen in Oklahoma. And, yeah, it really would be really creepy. I can't even imagine. And actually went out to that cemetery when I signed for the book just to see it, because I actually had never seen it. I'd only heard about it. But yeah, so, and that was basically the inspiration. And I, my husband, his in-laws all live in that area. They're from that area originally. And I just remember at some point hearing about disappearances and people, and somebody was visiting the house one day and was like, you know what, when people go missing, we usually think there's probably a reason, and there's not much of a reason to worry about it. There's probably a reason why they're missing. And that always stuck with me, like this idea that if someone goes missing, you know, there's a reason. There's not a lot of worry, unless it's somebody that you're surprised is missing. But like, there's a lot of disposable people, it seems. People who are drug addicts, people who, for some reason, live outside the norms of the town. When they come up missing, there's just not a lot of questions about that. And so I decided I would kind of put all that together in one package.
Yeah. Going back to what you said about, well, kind of about Stephen King, because I know I was always a big Stephen King fan, and so was Renee. So we're experts here now, right?
And we have a podcast.
We have a podcast. We're experts. We've read some books. One of the things he always does, or that I notice, is that he writes amazing characters.
Mm-hmm.
And his books, yes, there's crazy things, but it's about the character. And
right.
I think I kind of feel like that's what you've done here. So when you were writing this, is it the characters that came first and then you built the plot, or did it all come together, or how was that? Because I feel like you've made some really genuinely great people out of this book that just happened to be thrust into crazy situations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the characters were super important to me, and I do. That's so true about Stephen King. I feel like he doesn't get enough credit for like really being interested in people.
Right.
Yeah.
And his ability to like draw up a character who you care about and who you don't want to see hurt. I think that's really rare, actually, and people don't really notice that about him. But yeah, for sure, and that was really important to me. The character. I had like a few key characters that I knew I wanted to come in. I knew I wanted Levi. I knew I wanted this mother character who we get to see as a teenager. It's hard to remember now. It's been a while since I first wrote this. I think that it all kind of came together at once. So I did have a lot of revisions where I shifted people around, put people in, realized somebody was there just to prop up something and took them out, you know, that sifting through. But the characters were super important to me. I wanted the book to be about them more than the place, and I didn't want to get overwhelmed with what was happening to where we forget who they are.
Right. And I think, for me, that's one of the things that got me really into the story, because, and this is kind of, there is kind of a sub genre of like the small town secrets kind of story. And what makes those books interesting and different is two things and two things only. What the secrets are and who the people are that are involved in them. And if you don't have really strong characters, sometimes the secrets don't matter, because you're like, why do I give a shit? Because you have a lot of working, like you said, there's a lot of working parts in this story. There's a lot of different characters. There's some characters that are only there for a moment, but what is happening is important. So you have to care about all of these people, really. And that's kind of what the protagonist is dealing with, is like, as a newcomer to the town, trying to figure out if she cares and why she cares and if she should care. So if you have that kind of an interior battle going on with the protagonist and the reader didn't give a shit about the characters, it would fail pretty hard. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I guess one big question would be, I think we see a lot of stories about relationships between children and their parents after the parent has died. But they seem to fall, like, overwhelmingly, it's like a daughter trying to figure out her father that was always distant, or a son and the father, and in this case, it's a daughter and the mother, which I really like, because I think that they're, not that there's necessarily a dearth of stories like this, but to have one that was so alive, and you managed to make the Connie character so alive, even though she's actually not alive during the story at all. Was that something intentional, where you thought, like, you really wanted to work, like, the plot was kind of going to be built around her finding out things about her mother and understanding her mother, and that sort of weird, like, I don't know what to really call it, like, delayed grief, where finally, as an adult, you can accept who your parents are, even though they're not around anymore? Or was that something that happened the opposite, like the plot fed into that relationship, or did the relationship drive the plot, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah. I think the relationship drove the plot. And I think that what it goes to, like, what I wanted the point of the story to be, like, how do you overcome or stop a cycle that's bad? Is it through, like, rooting out who's evil and wrong and exposing them, or is it through kind of more of an embracing the complicated nature of things and saying, okay, this is me too. I do this too, and I can change, but I can also appreciate. So I wanted to have a kind of, I don't know, I've always wanted, like, I long for the horror story that's about, like, embracing and incorporating the monster instead of, like, killing the monster, you know? So to me, that part of it, the mother part, like, the mother is kind of, I don't know, she's not a monster, but she's not a completely positive character, at least from the Emily's point of view. Like, she's, you know, there's things that are difficult about that relationship and ways that she's taught Emily to be in the world that have not served her well. And I think to be able to forgive that is very tough. And it's something I wanted the book to some extent be about, or to land on in a way.
I think that the book has a, like, kind of an overall feel of acceptance and self-discovery, really. I think Emily's story is definitely one of those things, in herself and other people. I'm trying not to give anything away, but do you think that's fair, or that's accurate at all for the...
Yeah. I think so, and I mean, she was kind of the hardest character to write, the protagonist, which, I don't know, I should have maybe picked someone who was a little less, I feel like that character so doesn't know herself in the beginning of the book, doesn't really have any awareness of who she is, and so her figuring out, like, who am I in the context of history, of my mother, of where I would have lived if I hadn't lived this sort of different kind of life. Like, I think that's a big through line too. Like, who is she, and how can she figure out how to, like, create a self intentionally?
See, and that's one of the things I actually really liked about it, because you have a lot of stories where someone is starting over, like, in a similar manner to Emily. They kind of, like, that's it. I'm leaving the relationship and the job and the whatever, and I'm going to start new. And then you have this character that's just still really sure of themselves, and I feel like, well, that's bullshit. I've moved cross country. I know that's not true, you know? Yeah. And then there's even moments, too, like in the kind of romantic subplot where she's, like, really addressing interior, not necessarily in conversations with the other character, but she's addressing, like, a lot of stuff that goes through people's minds when they're entering into a new relationship after coming out of a long-term relationship.
Yeah.
You don't, you know, like, you don't go living with somebody, sharing a household with them, like, supporting all their dreams and having that blow up in your face, just like happily skipping into a new relationship while also there's people dying everywhere and, like, there's, like, a haunted lake or whatever, you know?
Yeah, it's too much.
So I really liked that. I liked that she was, you know, kind of aware of the fact that she had some growing to do and that it felt natural and it felt real. And it also served the story. It wasn't like, well, we got to jam this in so that this character is compelling.
Mm. Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. I did have worries about this character, that she's kind of passive, and it's a little tough to get people to rally behind a passive character, I think. Though, I mean, I think she loses her passivity as the story goes on, but... Yeah, I did worry about that character. Like, is there enough going on here? Is this person compelling? But I do feel like this sense of, like, who am I? I've, like, lost everything I knew, and I realized it was all sort of a prop just to keep me going. And what am I without all that stuff? I think that's a pretty legit question that a lot of people ask at certain points in their lives. So I hope it works for most people.
Yeah, I mean, I think... I don't know. I, like I said, I moved cross country for a guy, mm-hmm. and then we divorced. And we after, like, we'd been together, like, total 4 years or so. So I went through that whole, like, oh, my God, what the fuck am I doing? Why am I in this – not why am I here, like, on an existential level, but why was I in that specific place?
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing, like, trying to – make sense of all of it and, like, what is next? And then, like, how is what's next going to affect me? Because, like, this is weird. And I know a lot of people who've been through that, not necessarily after, like, the end of a long-term relationship, but just, like, they lose the job that they thought they were going to make a career and they have to get a job in a different area, so they have to move. Or, you know, a partner dies or something. There's all these sorts of, like, huge life events that happen where I think we go through, like, these little mini self-discoveries along the way. Like, you might know who you are, but do you know who you are as a parent before you have a kid? Mm-hmm. Like, no, you don't. And, you know, stuff like that as you go. So I feel like it's a relatively, like, universal thing, and it's handled so well in the book where you're, like, along for the ride with her on this. And it's not, like, the center focus. Like, it's not an angsty, like, I need to go to Paris and eat French food and make out with a mime to figure out who I am or whatever.
Kind of like Eat, Pray, Love, only, like, eat mime.
Yeah.
I don't know. Something. I don't know the third thing.
You don't want to know what the third thing is.
Oh, gosh. Well, I feel like I have to ask. There is an interesting, kind of could be risky, concerning how you look at it, style choice in your book, in that you don't use the quotation marks for the stuff. Was that something that came from, like, your poetry background, or was that just something you wanted to do for the novel? What kind of fueled that idea?
I think it's just poetry. I just, like, in poetry, I just stopped using a lot of punctuation that I realized I didn't need anymore. But I mean, it is a style of situation, and it does alienate a lot of people. I've realized in reading comments on Goodreads and other places, like, people are like, oh, I don't like this no quotation mark thing. I don't know. The more I started writing prose, the less I wanted, like, all this, all these quotation marks cluttering. I thought, like, if you don't need them, and if you can tell who's talking, why am I using this piece of punctuation? And I think it is, like, I think it lends to kind of the sort of floaty atmosphere. I kind of like the idea that you might accidentally attribute a piece of dialogue to somebody else, just because to me it seems more dreamy that way. Mm-hmm. But this is totally my poetry background, in that I kind of don't care enough about clarity sometimes. I realize that's a problem for me. Because I'm like, well, you know, this person could have said it, this person could have said it. Either way, it's interesting. But I think sometimes people do want to know who said something. So I did try to, like, make it clear. And that's something I had to go through and do a little more as I went. But, yeah, I don't use quotation marks anymore, ever. And maybe I should try it again to see if I'll like it.
Well, you know, Jose Saramago did that, and he won, like, a Nobel Prize. So don't let it get you down too much. there are people that do it, so it's fine. Although the book I read of his, I read it, was not sure I understood it all, and then had to get an audiobook version. And I was like, yes, okay, I've got it.
Interesting. Yeah.
But also, I mean, it's a foreign language book translated, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do wonder how clear it is, though, because to me, obviously, I know who's talking. I wrote it. Like, I'm not sure if everybody else knows, though. So I do want to be clear. I don't want to, like, intentionally make it uncertain what's happening. So that is something I think about. Like, how do I have this love affair with, like, cloudiness and ambiguity, and sometimes it's a little too much, so.
I think it's interesting that you say that, too, is, like, the whole idea of, like, well, of course I know, because I wrote it. And I think there's, like, this is kind of a craft question, if you don't mind. I think there is that line, right, if you're reading something and the author explains every single last detail, that you get bored really quick. You're like, I get it. I know. I figured that in order to get from work to home, that they would have to drive there. It's okay to start the scene at home, you know, or whatever it might be.
Right.
So when you're writing and you're thinking, like, you're trying to give the proper trust to the reader to do the work they need to do, and not overwhelm them, but also keep in check the fact that you know everything that's going on because you're the one writing it. How do you approach that, or do you just kind of hope for the best?
That's a tough one for me. I think I err on the side of, like, assuming the reader will figure it out. And I think sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes some of those things are not clear, and I needed to kind of step back. I think that's kind of a thing that's really good to have an editor for, to point out, like, oh, yeah, this you didn't really explain this, or this really doesn't make sense. I do think, like, having somebody else read a book is super useful just in terms of, like, does this make sense? So I have my husband read things, and I'll be like, just tell me, does this make any damn sense? Like, can you connect the dots to how this began and ended? That's all I want to know. And, you know, he'll usually say, no, it does not. Then I'll fix it. But I do trust the reader, but I also kind of trust just not really knowing what the hell is going on. I don't know. I kind of like not knowing what's going on sometimes. I don't really have a super big problem with, like, being lost a little bit. As long as I feel satisfied. Like, I think about, I don't know if what's his name? Kazuo Ishiguro? I don't know if I'm saying that right. He wrote this book, The Remains of the Day, which everyone knows. But he wrote this another book, which I just fell out of my head, the name of it. But it's this book that is so dreamy. And so, I still have no idea what happened, but I read the whole book, and it was a great experience, but I couldn't tell you the plot. I mean, I don't know what happened, really. What is the book that I'm thinking of? It's about this composer, and he's, I don't know. But anyway, I kind of, you'll sometimes feel okay with not connecting the dots, not knowing what's going on.
I feel you on that, because I'm the kind of person who watches, like, a mystery movie or, like, a movie with a, like, there's a puzzle to solve. And I kind of, like, I disengage myself from trying to figure it out. Because I want it to be revealed to me. I want to be surprised. I don't want to be, you know, there's some people that are like, oh, I bet this is going to happen. I bet that's going to happen. I'm like,
right.
I really just want to let this happen to me. You know?
Right,
that's
I agree.
I was going to say, I think that, that technique really lends itself to the genre that this book is, that sort of whodunit, why done it, and the suspense and the mystery of it. I am the type that will always try and figure out what's happening. Like, I can't just let it happen to me. I'm like, I am going to make 500 guesses about what I think this is before it happens.
Yeah.
And I can't
that's
stop myself. But well, and that's where I think it's good to leave maybe things out or not explain everything to your reader, because people like me who are trying to guess and trying to figure out what your end game is aren't going to be able to do it as easily.
Yeah.
So. Mm. I think that's a good point. I'm trying to decide if I'm cutting Renee off or not.
No.
Okay. I end up doing that all the time, and I hate it. Well, I think one of the things for our listeners that don't know your work, because this is your first novel, correct?
Uh-huh.
You have poetry for this. Okay. So I think one of the things that describes an author best to me is their personal loves and influences. And so I know we talked about Stephen King, but what are some other horror influences or writers that you love, or movies or whatever really speaks to you as far as horror? What's your love?
Yeah, this is a good question. So this is not so much a horror, that's a hard word to say, horror. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm saying it right. It's not so much a horror novel as, like, it's just very creepy and beautiful. It's Marilynne Robinson's book, Housekeeping. I don't know if you've read this. This is one of the books. I just love this book so much. And it's a literary novel. She wrote that book and then went years and years and years without writing another book. But it's just a story of these three women. And it's so creepy, and it's so sad, and that book has always stuck with me, and it's beautifully written. It's very dense, and that one is one of my very, very, very favorite books. In terms of horror, gosh, there's so many people, but it's all kind of, what do I like? I mean, I love kind of old standbys like Clive Barker, The Books of Blood. Those were ones I read when I was a teenager, and I was like, oh, this is great. Because he does have that sense of not really being interested in good and evil either, I think. That kind of subverting. And Hellraiser is one of those movies I love because of that. Like, I don't really know exactly whose side I'm on in that movie. Like, I kind of like the idea of there being this plane of existence where there is no sort of good or bad, and it's not really even, like, evil that where it comes from. It's just this different place where the rules are different. I kind of like writers who work in that way. Caitlin Kiernan, I'm not sure if I'm saying the name right, Drowning Girl, I've recently read that and really loved it. Let me think. And there are lots of poets I've loved who are a little bit dreamy and dark. I mean, Sylvia Plath is a big obvious one. Names are not coming to me easily, but there's lots of people.
That's okay. I have this really random story that I'm going to tell now for no good reason. But you said Hellraiser, so that always brings this to my mind. you can just think now randomly. This has been, I don't even know how many years ago now, but I went to, around Halloween, you know how they always have those haunted houses or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
So I went to one of the haunted houses with one of my best friends and her husband. And her husband, you know, he always makes fun of it, and it was so stupid and blah, 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 blah. Well, we get to the room that's going to be like the Hellraiser stuff. And you walk through and there's all the chains hanging from the ceiling and everything. And this guy who's like 30 feet tall, okay, not quite, but close, steps out from the side and puts his hand down on her husband's shoulder. And he says, I will bring you to your knees. And he just, I mean, he crumbled. He's like, okay, you know. It just killed him. He was terrified at that moment. I was like, see, they're scary. He's like, no, nothing else was scary, but that guy was terrified. Pinhead kills me. So every time I hear about Hellraiser, I don't even think of the movies first. I just think of his reaction to walking through that and coming face to face with Pinhead. Sorry. That was so random.
I love that. I absolutely love that. Anyway, speaking of Halloween.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Does anybody have, like, some super awesome plans for Halloween? I'm already fucking excited. I already wanted to go shopping.
Guys, you will not even believe all the stuff I already have for Halloween. It's pathetic.
No, but it's awesome. Tell us.
Okay. So, oops. Sorry, one of my speakers just fell off my desk randomly. It was the ghost of Halloween. I got these foam mannequin heads on special from Amazon, and so I'm going to, like, cover them in cheesecloth and hang them from my trees like ghosts, so that's what I've already got. We're putting floating candles in the hallway. We're going to have bats everywhere. We're really going all out for Halloween this year, because last year I didn't do a whole lot, and I don't know why. I think it was just, like, busy or whatever, but I just love Halloween, and I'm very, very excited about getting to do lots of stuff.
I think all we did last year was we hung our ghost that, like, dips down and goes, whoa, 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 when people walk by.
Oh.
But I'm in a new house. I know what that means. That means I gotta buy some new stuff, of course. You can't use just old stuff at a new house. There's a law against that. I'm almost positive.
Okay. A, do you dress up? B, do you already know what your costume will be? Go.
I'll let Leticia go first. Do you dress up? Do you know what you want to be this year?
You know, I love Halloween. Yeah, that's a good question. I love Halloween, and the last few years I haven't done much. Well, what I usually do for Halloween is I make my husband watch horror movies with me. Like, I start Halloween season. Like, it starts September 1st, and it goes till Thanksgiving. And that's Halloween season.
It starts September 1st. My husband doesn't believe that. He thinks that's a lie.
No. But last year, I was pregnant, and I was, like, super sick, and my Halloween was just not as fun as it could have been. But I did dress up as Susie Sue from Susie and the Banshees.
Oh, that's nice.
This year, I do not know, but I think I want Roscoe to have Roscoe's my son. He's going to be, like, five months old, so I don't know. I don't know if I can dress him up very well. He'll just probably eat whatever I put on him.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm either a pumpkin or Pat Benatar. I don't know why those two are in the running, but...
Oh, my God. That is amazing, though. I love that.
I wanted us to go as the Ghostbusters, and I was going to make my daughter dress as Slimer.
Oh,
cute.
Right? But my husband is going to be gone for Halloween.
Oh.
I'm like, I have, you know, and it's the right year to be the Ghostbusters, because it's 30th anniversary.
Oh.
So I don't really know. It just threw everything off. He's got to be away for work. So I got to figure it all out. I think I might do Gamora from Guardians of the Galaxy, just because, like, I like the idea of a lot of face paint.
I have... For Halloween, I have the most brilliant idea that I have ever come up with for costumes. You're all about to be very impressed, so please take a moment. Actually, I think I've already told Renee this, but anyway, still prepare yourself. So, since they did the Evil Dead remake with, they have a girl, basically, in Ash's role, Mia. So this year, my husband and I were going to do The Evil Dead / Evil Dead, where he can be Ash from the original and I can be Mia from the remake. So we can do both.
Do you want to hear something, though, Jessica? Because you told me you had the best idea ever, and you never told me what it was.
Really? Did I never tell you what it was? I'm kind of a jerk that way, apparently.
That is the best idea ever, though. I'm down with it. I'm excited.
I'm so in love with this idea. So, yeah.
It's a good one. I like it.
My daughter really wants the dogs to dress up this year.
See, my kid wants to do that, too. My son wants us to dress up the dogs. I'm like, they will just eat their clothes right off of them. There's no reason to do that.
My big dog probably wouldn't, because he just doesn't really react to things. He's just like he looks like a big old bear. And he just kind of, like, rolls through life being large. But I don't know about the new dog. She's a little bit more excitable than he is. She wants the new dog to be a princess.
I have cats, so there's no chance in dressing anybody up. It's not human.
I have a really fat orange cat, and I got him a pumpkin hat with a little collar that had, like, leaves on it. And he wouldn't wear the hat, but he's round and orange, so I just put the leaf collar on it and called it good. Anyway, okay. I got carried away there. It's like somebody said Halloween, and then it was like, oh. I've had, by the way, this is kind of Halloween related, mostly embarrassing. I've had 2 pumpkin spice lattes in the 2 days they've been available.
Oh, I've never had one of those before in my life.
I don't think I have either, honestly. And I love pumpkin stuff, but
I do too.
I live in a very small town. We don't have a pumpkin. The correct word would be coffee. We don't have a coffee place. So I don't know. We have pumpkin patches. We don't have coffee places.
I just started thinking about pumpkin flavored things and zoned out for a second. Yeah. we're actually really close on time. We have a few things that we need to talk about. First of all, the Books and Booze ice and whiskey challenge.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We have now 4 of those suckers floating around. We've raised a little bit of money. First of all, huge thanks to the people who donated. I guess we can thank them on the air because they said in their videos that they would be donating. So huge thanks to Gordon Highland and Caleb J. Ross for doing fantastic videos and donating even though they drank 2 drinks. Because for those of you who are not members of the Books and Booze listener group, first of all, what the hell is wrong with you? Why do you listen to this show and not have the benefits that you get from being in the listener group? You get to ask our guests questions. You get to be the first people to know about new episodes. You get privy to giveaways. You get all the information about our upcoming events. Like, join the listener group, okay? But the rules are, if you're challenged, and currently right now, like, it's been a very, like, everyone is challenged. Everyone is. Because it's a little bit easier that way. We don't want to pressure anybody. We know that we're not curing anything. We just really want to throw you guys a party at AWP. Like, really bad. We want to have a party and invite everyone. So what you do is you make a video, and you pour yourself a shot. You know, it's called the Ice and Whiskey Challenge, but you can have a shot of whatever. Jessica did rum. A lot of people are opting for whiskey. You pour yourself a shot, and you take it on your video, and then if you like us, you donate some money, however much you'd like, but consider it like, you know, I don't know, at least what it costs to buy a drink, right? Because if you don't want to donate, then you take another shot, effectively buying yourself a drink. Which is fine. We like it when people buy themselves drinks. The main thing here is that everybody has fun with it. We want to see lots of fun videos and have a good time with it because it's a cool thing to do and everybody likes to have a couple shots, right? That's a lie. I didn't enjoy it. I don't like taking shots. But But anyway, it should be fun, and we want to see more videos. We want to see people having a good time. And remember that you do not have to donate to make a video. You can just make a video and have fun with it. Second order of business is, by the time you hear this, it will be 2 days before Books and Booze Live in San Francisco. And we've got a lineup that will knock your fucking socks off. We're going to have Nick Mamatas, Joe Clifford, Tom Pitts, Constance Ann Fitzgerald, Travis Richardson, and Michael Paul Gonzalez all reading at 50 Mason Social House in San Francisco, which is a really cool little venue. And then, like, afterwards, we're going to go do karaoke, because apparently karaoke is what we do at Books and Booze now. Jessica, you had karaoke at your event in Louisville, right?
We did have karaoke, and it was spectacular.
So there you go. And then last but certainly not least, we are being... Oh, no, the music. This is cool, okay? Danielle found us a song called Echo Lake.
Ooh.
So we're going to listen to Echo Lake by Westy Reflector after discussing Echo Lake, which is pretty cool. And then did I see, like, this is embarrassing because I read the book and I should know, but didn't Joe Clifford's novel had an Echo Lake in it as well? Didn't I see something like you guys talking about on Facebook or something?
Mm-hmm.
So apparently Echo Lake, like, that's a thing that's happening right now. Hashtag Echo Lake. So, and then we're being brought to you by Keeping the Record by Travis Richardson. As I mentioned, he's going to be reading at our event this weekend. We did an episode with him where we discussed the book, and it's in your face, crazy crime novel about a baseball player trying to defend his record, even though he's like a total has-been. Lots of fun in that one, really entertaining. We'll link that up in the episode notes. We'll also be linking up Echo Lake and The New Black, as well as some other things we discussed, as usual. And then that's basically it. That's all our housekeeping. Leticia, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
And thanks for letting us have a look at the book, because it's fantastic. It's a great book.
Thank you.
Yeah, I recommend it. I feel like it's like just it's a really cool balance between a lot of different genres. So that's my tagline for it. There's a little bit of something for everyone in this one.
Ooh, I like it.
Yeah. And happy Halloween season, since we've declared that it's been going for 3 days.
Yeah.
It is now that time. I'm just so excited that you said that, because now what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave my office, I'm going to go in the living room, and I'm going to be like, I'm going to play that for my husband. I'm going to go, see? He wanted me to wait till October 1st. Like, that's even a thing.
No, that's too late.
Enjoy it. If it's in the store, it can be in your home.
That's the rule. If it's like spiderwebbing or fake graves, whatever it might be. I start on the inside and work out, because I don't want to overwhelm the neighbors, especially since we're new in town.
Let them know. Okay. Thanks, guys. This is so good.
Yeah,
this
is a fun show. So thanks again for coming, and we'll go out with Echo Lake.
Before it's too late. Into the